Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Aronto Douglas, an environmental human rights lawyer and an advisor to the new president of Nigeria. Aronto, welcome back to Berkeley.
Yeah, thank you, Harry. Thank you.
Remind us what it was like in the Niger Delta, where you're from, before the oil companies and the palm oil companies came to that region. It was really an idyllic natural paradise, wasn't it?
That's right, Harry. The Delta lies on the tropical forest belt of Africa in the West Coast. And it is a region that is blessed with a huge and interesting biodiversity of birds, animals, variety of fishes. And in fact, the people who live there didn't have to look elsewhere to be able to survive. It was a beautiful environment with clean air, water, and everything that can sustain life.
And you were born and raised there, and you came from a fishing family.
Yes, my parents are agrarian. My father, fisherman, you know, and farmer. My mother, a traditional midwife. And so we were rural. We were communal. We were people who live on land. We depend on nature. So that's the kind of setting where I come from, a community that is called Okoroba in present-day Bayelsa State.
Right. And your background and your family and the people around you really were in tune with nature, right? I mean, they saw their environment as a place to in a kind of a union with nature to eke out an existence, to survive, and then also to thrive.
That's right. You see, religion, survival, economics, we are all intertwined. Our culture was that which ensures that you do not violate or vandalize nature, because nature was there to provide for you, to provide for the community, to provide for humanity. That was the kind of nature that we have, the kind of situation, the environment we lived in. It was that same environment that provided the economic dynamics that allows you to be able to relate with or other communities who may not be fishermen or farmers. So you take your produce and then you go to those who are not involved in fishing and all that, and you can then do exchanges and you can then sell your produce and get money. It was a harmonious life or living where people from various communities live together in harmony with nature.
Mm-hmm. Then in the history of Nigeria, first this area became a source of palm oil for the colonialists and their companies, and then the oil companies came. So what you then experienced, I guess, in the last 50-100 years was intervention by outside actors to extract resources that were native to the area.
Yes, correct. The European economy, with the explosion of the Industrial Revolution, needed raw materials, needed those things that can fire the industries. Without being disrespectful to Europe had to depend on Africa for its raw material, because I think they didn't have enough to sustain the booming population, the industries that were exploding all over the place, and their relationship with resources was not one that allows them to remain at home, but to go on adventure. So Africa became a playing ground for the looting, for the taking, for the exploitation of resources to the betterment and development of Europe. So the palm oil era was once a momentous era where Europe needed palm oil for its industries. The Niger Delta was the epicenter for the production of palm oil. And Europe came, and Europe took, and Europe never really paid true value for the palm oil that they were taking. That was about 100, 200 years ago. Now, the oil industry came. Palm oil is still there, but by the 1956, oil was discovered in Oloibiri, in present Bayelsa State again, in the central part of the Niger Delta. Again, Europe came, then followed by the Americans, with all kinds of oil companies, Chevron, Exxon, Mobil, all. Then the Italians, Egypt, then the Dutch, Shell. All these companies descended on the Niger Delta and began another scramble for the capture of the resources of the peoples and communities of the Niger Delta.
And in your personal life, you were there when in an earlier period before the extreme devastation had come, and so you had gone away for schooling, and then when you came back, you really were in a position to see the difference between what had been and how that world had changed.
Yes, I left home very young. I haven't enjoyed the beauty, you know, the verdancy of what was there, the tropical forest, clean air and water. All those things I enjoyed as a child. Now, when I left home for education in the southwestern part of the country and later returned to Port Harcourt for my university education before going to England for my master's, I went home and the situation had changed. The river had been canalized, you know, forests had been vandalized. There was massive poverty everywhere. There was also anger. And it was not what we were used to. It was a big shock. It was not something that one could take. We have to discuss. We have to meet, to agree, to do something about the situation.
Mm-hmm. And let's be a little more specific. So in a way, what was affected was the despoiling of the land and the water with consequences for health, with consequences for earning a livelihood, sort of a kind of a devastation, a generalized devastation, but that I guess the people must have felt powerless to do anything about it.
Yeah, because the people were used to depending on nature. They want fish, they simply enter their canoe and go into the river. They want some fruits or vegetables or some roots, they go to the farm to collect and live. They never aspired to live an outlandish kind of life. Now, to now be forced to lose the clean water, the pure air that they breathe, to be forced to lose the fishes in the river and the animals in the forest to be driven away or killed or hunted. All this was too much for them to bear. It was a shock to them, and the communities have never recovered from it.
Mm-hmm. And where was the Nigerian government or the regional government as this situation evolved over time? I mean, I guess we now know that they were not there to protect the people.
Not at all, because if you look at the history of Nigeria, we got our independence from the British in 1960. And shortly after that, the military came in and took control of the apparatus of government, from local government to the federal. It was a command and control mechanism that they imposed. The soldiers were in total control of the country. Now, for almost 40 years, they were in charge. They ruled the country. They were in alliance with the transnational companies. They dominated the space. They dominated our life. They collaborated to ensure that the land, the water, the forest, the fishes and animals were not protected. This is sad. And these are our own Nigerians, fellow Nigerians, who were holding guns and dictating to the rest of the country that this is the way Nigeria has to be, according to them, to rule Nigeria through the barrel of the gun. That was the scenario until Popular People's Movement, pro-democracy movement, human rights activists, groups demanded that the military have to leave until we got our semi-independence from the second independence, if you like. If the first independence we got was from the British, we now have a second independence from the military authorities, which we got in 1999.
And how do you account for, in addition to being military regimes, how do you account for the corruption that took hold? Was it the overwhelming power of the oil companies, or was it the resources that were generated, which then could be privatized and put in the pockets of the leaders?
oil generally corrupts. Oil pollutes. Oil creates chaos and confusion in any place that it is found, whether it is in the United States or it is in Nigeria. If you look at what has happened in Nigeria, the emergence of the oil economy sort of created a situation where hardworking men and women had to surrender their hard work and wait for oil money to come to be shared. And in a situation where you don't work hard to get money, the situation will be for you to plot, to plunder, to plot, to destroy, to plot, to loot. That was a scenario that we were faced with. And corruption gradually began to seep in into the very politic of our governance system and affecting our social fabric. And the challenge now is to uproot corruption from the body politics and governance politics of Nigeria.
And let's unravel this a little more, because the revenues of the national government were mainly coming from the Niger Delta. I mean, 70 or 80% of that wealth. But it was not being returned to the local communities, which were the source of the revenue.
Yes, about 90% of Nigeria's resources comes from oil and gas in recent times. And it became clear that because of the nature of governance, the military dictatorship had appropriated these resources for themselves. At a point, they started a tokenistic return of some of the monies in what they called derivation. What the people were asking for was, give us back our resources. Let us then pay tax to the central government. Let us then pay tax to the state government or pay tax to the local government so that the governance system can be accountable. But that situation is yet to emerge. What we have today remains a system where the central government takes control of the oil resources and then shares to every level of government, local, state, and then federal. I don't know whether that is sustainable in the long term. The communities and peoples of the Niger Delta are saying that that is not sustainable. The rest of Nigeria needs to be convinced that that is the way to go, looking at what is happening in Canada, what is happening in the United States and elsewhere in the world, in relationship to how resources are used, controlled, and managed.
It's important to for our audience to understand that the oil companies that were the source of the wealth were multinational companies. So the capacity to control them was really weakened, even in the face of having a national government that was corrupt. Give us a sense of the immense power of a global entity operating in a place like Delta, the Niger Delta, and kind of the inability to act against them.
You see, the way the transnational companies operate in Nigeria is that they operate like emperors. They dominate the space. They control the extraction of the crude oil. They then pay whatever they extract to government. Government may not have the capacity to know exactly how much is produced from a particular oil well, because the technical capacity comes from the oil companies. Mm-hmm. So it is what the oil companies tell government that government then accepts. Mm-hmm. So over the years, from the 50s when oil was discovered, through the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s to the present, the relationship between the oil companies and government had been the relationship of the technical, knowledgeable, big, powerful partner dictating to the government as to what it wants. And that situation has not changed. Recently, government decided that they have to change the laws in which this relationship works. And a bill was submitted, the Petroleum Industry Bill, with a view to changing the dynamics of how this relationship is. And the oil companies are kicking against it. Their presidents from most of the companies are flying in to want to speak with the president. They have issued statements condemning the Petroleum Industry Bill. They have capacity. They can bribe. They can support elective officers to run for offices so that they can use those individuals to control government. It's huge. They are powerful. The power that the corporation have are not powers that can be controlled only by a country in one corner of the world. It has to be a global people's power, combined from the United States, Europe, Africa, and elsewhere, coming together to rein in on the transnational corporation and their power, especially their relationship to the environment, to human rights, to justice, to equity, and to governance.
And it's important to as we pursue this, that to understand that this raw power that comes from a base in the technical means of extracting the oil and then selling it spills over into the hiring of private security forces, to the suppression of media that might do human interest stories, for example, on what happens to a family in that region.
That is very correct. When you have money, you can control the world. That seems to be the gospel that the oil companies are preaching. We have the money, so we can control what we want the rest of the world to hear. And the story of the Niger Delta people had not gone global because of the counterforce by this crude money controlled by the transnational corporation with a view to suppress the information, to suppress the truth. And this is not right. The rest of humanity needs to know that there's a part of humanity called the Niger Delta in the beautiful country called Nigeria, demanding attention, demanding that justice be done, demanding that the waters be cleaned, that the land that is polluted in the last 5 decades be cleaned and restored and rehabilitated, so that the greens, the livestock, the birds can thrive. That is a challenge that we are facing right now.
Now, as an attorney, you started early in the environmental movement coming out of the Niger Delta. And talk a little about the evolution of that process, because, you know, we began with the degradation and the spoiling and the loss of livelihood and the health consequences. And then people in the face of this power and this exploitation of the environment start feeling very powerless and not understanding probably what they have in common. So what is the role of an environmental activist who's a lawyer in both mobilizing this content and channeling it to make it politically effective?
Well, Harry, personally, as a young boy growing up in the village and seeing what I saw, you know, in the village, and especially when I returned and realized that what I was used to was not there, it became clear that I have to use a means to reverse the negativities that we are confronted with as a people. And the best way, I thought at the time, was to look at the instrumentality or mechanism of human rights, environmental justice. And I had to go to school to be able to study that so that I can give help to the helpless. I can give help to the poor. I can give help to the voiceless in the communities. And there are thousands, there are millions of people who need help and are not getting help. So our evolution from being a victim to being an advocate for equity, for justice, was a natural occurrence that was impelled, you know, encouraged by the determination to see that justice is done. Those inspiration that came to us is going to come to thousands of people, whether in the United States or elsewhere in the world, so that justice for our planet is done today, not tomorrow.
And in the particular case of the Niger Delta, was it impossible to achieve for success for quite a while through politics and electoral politics because the system was so corrupt? And then did you have to turn to law?
It has to do more with the nature of government that we had. Like I mentioned, we were under military jackboot military dictatorship for many, many years. In fact, there was an election that was conducted in 1993 that the military had to annul. They didn't want the man who emerged, Chief MKO Abiola, to take over power under a democratic means. It was the freest and fairest election that Nigeria had ever conducted in its history. Yet the military didn't allow it. So the military was there to suppress the will of the people for justice, for democracy, for equity, for the restoration of the environment. So it has been a long drawn battle between the people, between people's power and a minority few who took control of the guns of Nigeria and turned those guns against the people. It's been a struggle between the peoples of Nigeria against the a tiny minority of transnational corporations who control the money and use that money to suppress the people living their land, the environment devastated, vandalized, and completely in a state of absolute collapse. That is what we are confronted with. So people's power has to rise up. People's power must stand and demand justice. And that process is now gradually taking shape.
Now where is there a fine line that can be crossed where protest becomes insurrection? You know, and how have you dealt with that in the region where, because this pool of resources that can be stolen, can one imagine leave to kind of private armies that essentially are in the, that can become as greedy and as ruthless as the government itself?
When you suppress people's power from rising, you create an avenue for discontent. You create an avenue for a group of people to capitalize on that situation to create other sort of situation that you may not be able to control. There has, over the years, emerged at any point in time different kinds of responses to the situation we find ourselves. In the late 90s, the youths of the Niger Delta rules and demanded justice. They worked under various axes, either through Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People, or through the Joy Youth Council, or through the Ishekiri Movement, or the Isoko Urobo. You know, and so many movements that are all over the Delta. These, they all originate from nationalities, peoples, communities. And these movements have largely insisted that justice must be done in the Niger Delta and in the wider Nigeria. Now, in the last couple of years, the message from the Delta is beginning to spread throughout the country. People are beginning to see that what is happening to the Niger Delta people is unjust, it is unfair, it has to be corrected.
Now, we are in a new political situation in Nigeria, which offers a possibility for real change, building on the kind of movements and struggles that you've talked about. Tell us about the new president and how he came to power.
Goodluck Jonathan is an academic. Holds a PhD in zoology and had been teaching most of his life. Now, he was invited to politics, and then fortunately he became the deputy governor in 1999.
Of a region.
Of a region.
Yeah.
A state, Bayelsa State.
Yeah.
Just like Florida or Louisiana or so. So from there, his career moved up. But before taking up the political position of deputy governor, he was the director of ecology in the Oil Mineral Producing Development Commission. He's an environmentalist. So he grew up in that environment where all these things are happening. From being deputy governor, he became governor, then he became a vice president, then acting president, and last in May, he became president of Nigeria. So he has this experience of research, of scholarship and politics to be able to see how justice can be brought to bear on the issues of the Niger Delta and in the governance of Nigeria. He is the second graduate to govern Nigeria. The first was the late president. He is the second. Before this time, no Nigerian head of state had gone to university. These two were the first. So he comes into the office of president with this power of scholarship, the power of academia, and the relationship that research and human relationship can be brought to bear. He comes into office with the power of politics, having been there for the last 10 years, studying and knowing the dynamics of governance from the lowest, lowly level of deputy governor to now the president of the country.
And you are an advisor for strategy to the new president.
Correct.
Tell us about your role.
Well, my job is to assist in clarifying issues. He can bounce things off me policies that are evolving. We can also make some suggestions on policies. But essentially, our duty, our job is to look at those things that affect the governance of Nigeria, whether it is the Niger Delta, whether it is energy, it is power. It is to look at how the best policies can get to the table of the president. And those policies are not those boogie policies intended to undermine the good governance process that the president intends to deliver, especially based on his promise to the people, to his people. When he came into office, he promised Nigerians that he's going to focus on three things. He was going to focus on electoral reform so that the leadership recruitment processes threw up credible people in the various level of government. He was going to focus on energy, and especially with relationship to electricity. A vast majority of our people don't have access to electricity.
Something like 70%?
Exactly. Then, thirdly, he was going to focus on the Niger Delta. Nigeria, like we said in our conversation, depends 90% of its resources on oil, on the Niger Delta. He's going to focus on that. Today, as we speak, there is an amnesty program that has been granted to those who took up arms to challenge the transnational companies and the government that things were not working. That amnesty program is on. It is also intended to ensure that those who are angry, those who are disempowered, those who feel development has to come to the communities, like people like myself, we feel development has to come to our communities. We don't have to come to Lagos or Abuja to be able to see roads, to see electricity, to see clean water. That all these good things ought to be in the villages and communities where this oil and gas is taken up for the benefit of Nigeria, the benefit of the United States, the benefit of Europe and America and the rest of the world. Why should the people who produced oil and gas be left to the ravages of poverty, underdevelopment, and total injustice?
Now, the system you described before the present time that had evolved over many years, how do you see it as an obstacle to move it in these positive directions, and what are the minefields that the new president has to watch for, and how does he navigate the shoals? Because institutional ways of doing things have been built up over time that reflect the corruption that we've been talking about.
Well, the president is faced with a lot of obstacles. Nigeria is a country where we have about almost 250 ethnic nations that was cobbled together by the British through amalgamation. That the old ways of doing things had been to see the country in regions, in sections, and in blocks, rather than looking at the commonality of our country, rather than looking at talents, rather than looking at things that we can do to bring justice to everybody. So it will have to overcome those obstacles of regionalism, obstacle of sectionalism, obstacles of individualism. These are critical obstacles that he has to overcome. He also has to overcome, because in the last 50 years, people have made so much money from governing Nigeria. So they are so powerful, and they have amassed this wealth, and they can use this wealth to destabilize any government that is in power that does not kowtow to their wishes. So he has also to understand that these are there. The other obstacle is the obstacle of the transnational corporation. Will they give him chance to reform the governance processes in the oil industry? Will they give him chance to look at the whole question of environmental degradation and responsibility? Will they give him time and opportunity to look at the whole question of sustainability in terms of responsiveness and responsibility of the transnational corporation to the communities? Will they give him time to protect the culture of the people, to protect the environment of the people? Will they support him in doing that? These are the challenges that Goodluck Jonathan, president of Nigeria today, is faced with. However, he has opportunity, and he has certain blessings. The blessings are, he by nature is a very calm, humble, and very intellectual person, and he is not arrogant. So he has the capacity to attract people to himself. He also has a huge support from the youths of Nigeria, who are on the receiving end of bad governance. The youths of Nigeria today, a majority of them are not employed. The youths of Nigeria today are yearning for change. They demand to take charge. They want to be in government. They want to be in politics. They want to be able to bring their talents to bear. They are not being given the opportunity. So Goodluck Jonathan has that support of the youths to say, go ahead and change things. And about 60% of the population of Nigeria are between the age bracket of between the age of 15 and 45. So it's a critical mass that is there to support him. So if those old guards do not support him, the youths will rise and say, change is now. And I am very optimistic that changes will follow.
With your background in the environmental movement, you must have a real sense of, on the one hand, mobilizing constituents, channeling their disconnect, but also thinking about how you involve people in the institutions that are emerging. How do you do that at the presidential level? Because as somebody from a particular region, you know, where you're on the ground and so on, but when you're thinking nationally, we in the United States have had hopes in the recent election for there to be major reform, and there's some disappointment here when reform isn't institutionalized in the way we hoped. What do you see as the problems for your president?
Well, the challenge of mobilization, the challenge of institutionalization, is actually lies in the challenge of understanding and having the key to unlock those challenges. To mobilize the people, you must put in those policies that will attract them. To institutionalize a policy, the policy must be right. Now, what are those policies that need immediate and urgent institutionalization? Electoral reform. We need to have credible elections that the nation will have trust in. The rest of humanity, the international community, will bear testimony to. And that is a big challenge. However, to mobilize the people to bring that about will mean that the messages must go to every individual who has a right to vote, who has a stake in our democracy. And that message must be sent out. We have to use all resources available to us, radio, television, newspapers, community movements, community structures, to be able to get this message to the people. The NGOs, the CBOs, all must be involved, because to mobilize this critical constituency is important. Power has to be returned to the people. Power has remained in the hands of a few. The challenge now, the biggest challenge, is to return power to the people so that the people can control those who govern.
You were a guest on our show in 2001, and I went back in preparation for today's interview to look at that transcript. And at that time, you said you had traveled to the Gulf of Mexico in the United States, and you saw that the situation there with the oil companies, that they reminded you of the situation in the Niger Delta. And we now are in July 2010. We've had the BP explosion, and I think that what you were saying then has new meaning for everybody in the United States. So first thing I want to ask you is sort of reflecting on this evolution of your own insights over time and how it affected the Niger Delta region. Give us your thoughts on what we're witnessing in the Gulf today. We're in approximately day 68 of the BP oil disaster.
You see, I traveled along the Gulf Coast in 2001. I visited communities and I saw with my very eyes the problems that transnational corporations were causing. But those problems at the time paled into insignificance. If you relate that to what is happening in the Gulf today, the BP explosion created and changed the game. Whereas the pollution we saw in Louisiana and other communities in the Gulf many years ago was the kind of pollution that somebody who lives in New York or San Francisco or or Charlotte will not see, because it is not in his or her backyard. The BP spill dramatized and globalized the pollution that an oil company can do to a people. Now, if you take that back to my homeland, from the Gulf of Guinea to the Gulf of Mexico, from Bielsa to Florida, you will realize that the pollution that has occurred today is one that is devastating, not just the immediate communities where people will not see, it is destroying the entire region. On July the 4th, I watched television program of empty beaches in America. These were beaches that were used to be flourishing. These were beaches that turtles come to nestle. These were beaches that birds, now coated in crude, are now being seen everywhere. If you compare the dramatic pollution in the Gulf of Mexico to the pollution in the Niger Delta, again, the Gulf of Mexico pollution pales to insignificance, because for 50 years, we have had an equivalent of an Exxon Valdez every year in the Niger Delta. So we've been having an Exxon Valdez a year. We've had more than 7,000 polluted sites in the country and several millions of barrels spewed into the entire region. It is a shock. The world needs to rise. The world needs to say enough is enough.
Now, in your work in the Niger Delta, I have a sense, knowing your career and in our previous interview, that for you the global struggle was a very important one, that in a way I think you had come to the conclusion that you couldn't change things to where they really mattered until the world saw this problem of the Niger Delta as part of a global problem. And the global problem is one in which we have this ravenous thirst for oil, and we need more and more of it, and it's harder and harder to find, which helps us understand the BP disaster, at least in part. So talk a little about that. What do you see as the potential for this American catastrophe to reverberate globally, to actually change global perception, so that in a way, and this is a horrible thing to say, but because of the Gulf of Mexico, we will better be able to better perceive the pain of the Niger Delta?
That is correct. A situation where a transnational company like BP will go 2 miles down the Earth crust to extract crude for our domestic use in America and elsewhere in the developed world is not something we were able to appreciate. Now, as we speak, the world now knows that oil companies can go as far as that to bring out oil. And things may have been going wrong that we never knew. If that incident had not happened, the world would not have been shocked to realize this devastation that is happening. It is sad, but because of the BP spill, the Niger Delta now is being seen in a new way, in a more urgent way. What is hidden is now being revealed. It is important from my point of view, and from the point of view of the communities and peoples of the Niger Delta, that the injustices visited on these communities and on the region, that those injustices need to be corrected. And it is a responsibility of the global commons. It is not just one community. We cannot do it alone in San Francisco. We cannot do it alone in New York. We can't do it alone in Lagos or Abuja. We have to come together to say what is happening today must not be allowed to continue. Communities have to be protected. Laws will have to be brought into place. Multinationals have to be properly monitored and punished. President Obama responded very quickly and swiftly by demanding that BP should set aside $20 billion for payment of compensation. In Nigeria, it is not happening. The transnational companies will not do it. Last week, a court in Port Harcourt handed down a judgment against Shell for a historic pollution in a community called Ezama Ebubu that Shell should pay $100 million to the communities for pollution. What did Shell do? Within 48 hours, they had gone on appeal, and they will use the law to delay justice for another 50 years. This is what we face. We insist that Shell should take that $100 million, just like President Obama did with BP, that they should deposit the $100 million in an interest-yielding account. That is critical. The president of Nigeria cannot order Shell to do that because the matter was a court decision. So the court, we are insisting that Shell, rather than appealing as they have done, which is their right to appeal, they should deposit that money in an interest-yielding account. We have several of such cases that had been trampled upon by the monstrous power of transnational companies.
So what you're saying is that the American shock to this catastrophe and the Obama pushback, which however inadequate has been, will have consequences globally in the sense that it will become an example for other countries that are much weaker in their dealing with oil companies.
Absolutely, but, so.
But also you're suggesting that in a way this has furthered the delegitimation of the oil companies in a way that all of the disturbances in the Niger Delta did not.
You see, one thing that the PP spill revealed is that oil companies all lie. When the pollution occurred, BP said only 5,000 gallons was being spewed into the waters, into the ocean. It became clear that what was being spewed was several thousands of barrels, over 60,000 barrels or so, being pumped into the oceans, into the waters of ordinary people of America. So if they lie, if they can lie in the United States, you can magnify that lie a million times in the Niger Delta. So where, for example, they say spill was caused by sabotage, you can be rest assured that the spill was caused by corrosion, by malfunction, by carelessness and recklessness that has become the stock in trade, because most of these pipelines, most of this infrastructure were laid in the 70s.
This is in Nigeria.
In Nigeria, yes.
Yeah.
So it's important that the world come to understand that the issue of oil and gas, the extraction of resources, cannot be resolved only by the communities and peoples of Nigeria. The buyers of the oil of Nigeria, which is the ordinary people of America, about 10% or 14% of oil from Nigeria comes to the United States. So ordinary people in America needs to know that there are people in the Niger Delta who are not getting benefit enough from what is being extracted from their land, leaving their land bedraggled, devastated, and comatose in a way that it may take a millennia to be able to recover. So it's important that a global strategy led by people's movements, ordinary people, come together to support policies, programs that will lead to a reversal of the oppressive tendency of transnational companies on communities and people, whether in the United States or in Nigeria, whether in Brazil or in South Africa. Regardless of where this is happening, companies must be brought to account.
And I guess I am not sure in my own mind yet how this will happen. I understand where if Obama pushes back and your president or your courts follow that example, that begins to happen. But if you look at the tragedy here in the Gulf, it's quite amazing that the coverage on our media, with rare exceptions like the New York Times, has not made a comparison with the situation of comparable regions like the Gulf. You don't see news clips on the evening news here comparing the Gulf with other parts of the world. You see the anguish of the people, and that's a very important building block. But what is going to be the connectivity, the connection, the link, the spark that makes people here see how their plight is like the people there in Niger Delta?
Well, I don't want to be cynical. Maybe you need another BP explosion.
Yeah.
And another one. in a way that is happening in Nigeria, to be able to shock the rest of the United States to know that this is a war being waged on the United States. It's an ecological war being waged on the United States. We have been facing that war for 50 years. You know, we've been shot at. We have been, suppressed. The communities have been devastated and destroyed, all because of oil. If you don't take steps to correct and stop what is happening in the Niger Delta, it will become the norm elsewhere. I think it is because they were getting away with murder in Nigeria that they thought they could get away with murder in the United States. Unfortunately, this is a developed society with advanced media and information. And when it happened, they literally, all the networks beamed their television station into the spill as it spews out. And that shocked the United States. And we need to be able to understand that correcting the BP spill in the U.S. without correcting the spills in the Niger Delta will lead to further spills and more anger and anguish, which will not be to the benefit of the common happiness of humanity.
Now, we are doubly guilty in a way because we are the devourer of the oil, especially, as are other industrial societies, and we probably have done the least to move in a direction of not needing the oil. How do you see that as part of this equation? Because it is the case that we need the oil, and it is the case that on the Gulf Coast, a lot of those communities benefit from the drilling of the oil. So the governors are ambivalent about screaming bloody murder because they're afraid that they will drive the oil companies away.
Well, the governors need to look at 50 years down the road, 100 years down the road. Oil was not here 200 years ago. And the generation that is to come, what will they say of their ambivalence? What will they say of their temporariness in looking only at the immediate benefits that they get? They have got to look at how to protect those beaches, how to protect the coast, how to protect the rivers and waters for generation that is to come. If politics is about thinking of the present, then politics is dead. Politics must be about thinking of the present and the future in a way as to protect the people of the now and the tomorrow. If we don't have that in place, then whoever is following an agenda of selfish protectionism of the now is leading that community or those communities to doom. We cannot be part of that. We've got to look at the situation 50, 100, 200 years down the road, 1,000 years from now. What are we going to give or surrender to the generations yet unborn? Are we going to be selfish in the present and live a very high standard of living, good quality of life, and then the people that are coming are then surrendered to live a reckless life, short life, a life of ill health, that they will not be happy? Why should we be happy now and create unhappiness of the future generation? I don't think it's right. The governors need to rethink their strategies. They need to support the ordinary people of the United States to say no. Now is the time to move to alternative energy that will ensure that planet Earth is protected.
If in our audience out there are people watching, what would you like them? And obviously they're watching daily what's happening in the Gulf. What would you like to leave them with in terms of a message? Because clearly you've been in a region that has suffered catastrophes like this that's happening in the Gulf many times over, and you've actually worked politically at changing the situation. What is the central lesson then, once they see the comparison with what happened in your region? What is the added element that you have learned that you can convey to them?
Well, the message to people who are just witnessing or experiencing oil spills, the lesson and message is that oil spill kills. Oil pollution devastates. Oil pollution creates chaos, confusion, and disunity and disorganization wherever it occurs. Oil spill corrupts. Oil spill has a tendency to ensure that the tomorrow's generation do not benefit the bounties and beauties of the present. It is important that the bounties and beauties that I speak about as a child growing up, which I then later did not see as a young adult growing to become an adult gradually, that changes. It's not what you want to present to the children of tomorrow, to the youths yet unborn. This is a challenge we need to tackle.
And if students were to watch this program, how would you advise them to prepare, you know, for their future? You emphasize that the youth vote is a very important constituency, the people who are going to live in the future. So how should they prepare for the future, both in terms of their study and their activism?
The future belongs to the student. Every student now is either a leader tomorrow or the maker of a leader tomorrow. You are a citizen and you are a patriot. It is important that students organize, they mobilize to support processes that ensures that transnational companies do not run riot on lands of the poor, of the helpless. It is important that they organize and mobilize to insist that regulations, strong regulations, are instituted to prevent the vandalization of land and resources of poor, powerless, defenseless people. It is important that students study the impact of pollution in the present and in the future so that they will be able to take steps to ensure that when they become leaders, when they take control of power, they won't have to be thinking of cleaning up what others have come to leave behind. It is absolutely important that students studying and watching what is happening in the Gulf of Mexico understand that a greater magnitude of pollution is happening in the Gulf of Guinea in Nigeria. It's important that they take that on board and collectively come together to address this.
One final question. If you happen to be present, and it's not impossible, at a meeting between President Barack Obama and President Goodluck Jonathan, what would you like to be on the agenda that relates to the issues that we've been discussing?
Cooperation between both countries to rein in the transnational companies, to advance the whole question of alternatives, energy, new technology, to bring about a better, cleaner planet. That will be on the agenda. Second on the agenda is good governance. Cooperation between the two governments to ensure that accountable leadership is on top of the situation.
On that note, and hope for the future, Aronto, I want to thank you for your work in Nigeria and globally, and thank you for coming back and being on our program.
Thank you so much, Harry. Thank you.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.